So good morning, everybody. Let's continue with the most exciting topic at this wonderful university, medical image processing. We are currently in the chapter that students actually appreciate the most. In the past, we always ask, which topic did you like the most? And the feedback was always very positive with respect to the chapter on reconstruction. And that is the reason why we extended the chapter on reconstruction a lot and put way more mathematics in it, and let's see how things develop. Before, we talked about what we can do with respect to single images. So we are familiar with basic pre-processing methods that allow us to do image correction. So this is somehow deviating from standard image processing books where you read filters like mean filtering, Gaussian filtering, and all these standard technologies. Here we looked into very specific and rather new methods to do a proper pre-processing that decides at the end of the day on the final image quality that you have in a radiology department. And we know a little bit about modalities, but I have to emphasize that we are not considering these modalities in very detail, and we also didn't talk about physics due to the lack of knowledge of the professor in this field. Yeah? And the medical engineering students, they had a whole semester in their first year on different modalities and maybe have a better understanding of it. But just for you, if you heard it the first time, it's totally enough what you have learned to write algorithms for pre-processing, reconstruction, and image fusion. That is going to come in a few lectures from now. And if we talk about reconstruction, we focus here in this lecture on X-ray computed tomography. You all know that also in MR, magnetic resonance imaging, reconstruction is required. And these methods that we actually discuss here can be used as a basis for the MR reconstruction technique. So we focus on X-ray CT, X-ray computed tomography. Good morning. X-ray computed tomography. And the basis for reconstruction is that we have projections for a given angle at a given point on the detector that are basically nothing else but a line integral through the function that we are going to reconstruct. Yeah? So we integrate over a line, and we have different lines for different angles, and we integrate over these lines and get here for each element on the detector, transformed element on the detector. We have to apply this logarithm transform, an integral of the function. So the task of CT reconstruction is nothing else but compute a function in the simplest way, compute a two-dimensional function using different line integrals. So we have different line integrals and integrate along the line the 2D function we want to reconstruct. And based on these line integrals, we compute the original function. And now the question is, how many line integrals do we need to come up with a good solution? And there is a mathematical proof that we need an infinite number of line integrals. And then you have the proof that you need an infinite number of line integrals, and then you can say as a mathematician, I don't go for the system because I need an infinite number of line integrals and I will never get that, so I can't build the system. Engineers say we ignore the mathematical result and we just build it and say it's good enough, and it's actually good enough. Yeah, that's also what engineers have to learn. It's good enough. I know that there is no solution, but I have one and it's good enough. Yeah, that's engineering. So how many line integrals do we need? From which directions do we need the line integral? So there are a lot of theoretical theoretical questions that have to be answered. And it's also important for engineers to understand the theoretical constraints of the whole system. But at the end of the day, for coming up with a practical solution, we have this in the back of our mind, and we always double check things. But when we build it, sometimes we have to ignore theoretical constraints, yeah, and just do it. Okay. And the method we carved out was the so-called filtered back projection. Back projection. It's really a pleasure to write with this. It's the filtered back projection. And the filtered back projection is based on the Fourier slice theorem. What is the Fourier slice theorem telling us? Yixin?
The Fourier transform of the projection data in one direction in the one side in the Fourier domain.
That's the picture you should keep in the outer shell of your brain. That's the function we want to reconstruct. That's the X-ray projection using parallel projection rays. We compute the Fourier transform, and we find this Fourier transform in the Fourier transform of the function we want to reconstruct. Yeah? And this is parallel to the detector line. So we look at the 2D Fourier transform along a line that is parallel to the detector line. Yes, sir. Yes, please. Okay.
And
the filtering and the back projection, yes.
Okay, and I think I understood the Fourier slice theorem, but I don't understand how they come together. Because in Fourier slice theory, we had this 1D Fourier transform, and then we had this this 2D backwards Fourier transform of the coordinate interpolation.
Yes.
But now we're doing filter back projection. Filtering the same filter for the polar to Cartesian transformation, and then we're doing back projection, and somehow magically without Fourier transform it's the same. Why is that?
Ah. Okay. Who wants to answer? I mean, I never read a book on filtered back projection. Nah. Who knows about the answer? I mean, Max, Tobias. Tobias is right. I mean, I was doing all the stuff with the Fourier transform and, you know, with the magic eye and blah, blah, blah. And you had the feeling, whoa, 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 it's so complicated. And then I did a coordinate transform. I came up with the absolute value function, this RAM filtering. And at the end of the day, I came up with an algorithm that is not considering Fourier transform at all. Who has an idea what happened? How would you answer his question? First, you screwed us up with all the Fourier transform, and in the end of the day, you came up with a method that ignores the Fourier transform at all. There is one important part in it. So we write down the Fourier slice theorem. Basically, we wrote down the Fourier transform of the function we want to reconstruct. Then we have replaced the function that we want to reconstruct with the function that we have observed with the Fourier slice theorem. Then we did the coordinate transform and we got in this W absolute value. And then we saw the following. We take the Fourier transform of the observation, of the measurement. We take the absolute value of W, the V function, where we had this picture in mind. So we sample, if I take this idea and I rotate around the patient, then I sample the 2D Fourier transform with this star here. And you know, here is the origin on the detector, and here is the first value, the second value, the third value, and so on. So we have here polar coordinates of the Fourier transform. That's the 2D Fourier transform, okay, in polar coordinates. And then it turned out that we have the 1D Fourier transform multiplied with this, and then we have this e to the power of I something integral, blah, blah, blah. This here is a product in the Fourier domain. A product in the Fourier domain corresponds to a convolution in the spatial domain. This here was an inverse Fourier transform because there was a positive I. That means we take the two Fourier transform, multiply, and then we do a back transform. And after the back transform, we integrate over all the angles, we do the back projection step. So we get rid of the Fourier transform using the fact that we have a multiplication of two Fourier transform and then nothing else but an inverse Fourier transform. And then we said, if it's a product of two Fourier transforms and an inverse Fourier transform, this corresponds to a convolution in the spatial domain. Yes, sir. Annoying.
But yeah, so we have a 1D Fourier transform and a 2D Fourier back transform, and they are interchangeable?
No. I mean, you remember when we looked at the 1D Fourier transform of the projection for y is 0?
Yeah, okay.
And that's how we moved from the 1D Fourier transform to the 2D, where we had 0 times epsilon. At 0 times y, and then we rotated it. Yeah?
Yeah.
Huh?
Okay.
Yeah, you still agree with the fact that this is cool, or?
Yeah, it's very cool.
It's okay. Good. Once again. Can you give me a good intuition why the multiplication with absolute value of W is required, Ludwig? Good morning, Ludwig. How do you feel today? Yes. Yeah, but that's a very mathematical explanation. I'm sure you won't remember this 10 years from now.
I think it causes the inner wave to be less more weighted than the outer.
Right. You know, in the inner part, we have a denser sampling than far away from the center. And that means that each point, each sample that is in the center should have a lower contribution to the final result, because we have many of them, than the outer ones. Because there we have a sparse sampling, and each sample is more important than the inner ones. Huh? So that's the intuition. We multiply with this. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
You had a nice weekend?
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. So this is the weighting factor. So here we have smaller ones, and then we have larger ones. And last week we also considered approximations of absolute value of W in the spatial domain. So, and what we did is, like we do it with filtering, high-pass, low-pass filtering. For instance, we first smooth things and then we find edges. These two steps are combined, and the same we do here. We have seen the Ramlak filter. That is a good approximation of the spatial domain filtering that ends up to be W's absolute value. And then we combine this with a smoothing filter, and we have seen that this makes sense, and in terms of noise propagation, this is a good idea. Sir?
Do you sometimes problems with the sampling theory in the other part?
The question is whether I have problems with the sampling theorem. Yes, sir, we have. We have problems with the sampling theorem, and the rule of thumb is that you need a certain number of projections at least to get a good reconstruction using this, and this is some I'm not remembering it correctly, but it's 2pi times the number of elements I want to have defined somehow, the number of projections. But I'm not sure about this. I'd never looked into it in detail. And why didn't I never look into the detail? Then you can say, hey, you're not theoretically interested. That's right. Basically, we follow the rule. The more data we get, the better. And basically, we use what the system gives to us. And whether this is sufficient or not, we take the maximum number and say, this is the best image quality you can get. And then we try to reduce the dose and the number of projections and look at the final image quality. When is it still sufficient, yeah, to deal with the trade-off of dose that you apply to the patient and the outcome of image quality? Because it's not so much important for us to have the most brilliant images. The combination is important. Yeah? How much dose do I have to apply to get an image that has a high diagnostic value, that the doctor sees what he wants to see and do the proper therapy based on these images? Okay. So the reconstruction, combining the Fourier slice theorem and the coordinate transform, ends up with a reconstruction algorithm that requires the convolution of the projection with a filter, and then we integrate over all the angles. Yeah? So the filtered back projection algorithm is doing nothing else but we acquire the images, give it to the filtered back projection algorithm, then we convolve projection number one, projection number two, projection number three, projection number four with a high pass filter. That is actually the spatial domain representation of the absolute value function. Okay? And then we integrate for all the rotation angles these filtered projections. What means we smear the projected values along the projection lines through the function we want to reconstruct. And like a miracle, the structure of the object grows out of it. Okay? If we do not apply the high pass filter, we also get we get some kind of structural information, but it's a very blurred image. That's also what we thought about 3-4 lectures ago, and is a good indicator that without filtering, just the back projection step includes some information that can be used. Okay. Are we happy so far? Yes, we are. Good. Did you see? I bought a new computer with an HDMI. So I don't need the adapter anymore. I just have a HDMI. I just plug it in without having all these cables. And it's a larger computer. So what does it tell you? It's a natural constant. Either the computer is small and you need hundreds of adapters, and the weight is the same like this one where you don't need an adapter. So it's, or like a bicycle and the lock, it's the same rule. Yeah? The lightweight your bicycle is, the heavier your lock will be, and the sum is always constant. That's a natural constant. That's what I learned at MIT, by the way. That was at the welcome reception what they told us. Lock your bike. Good. Okay, are we happy? Yes, we are. Should I proceed? Yes, I should. Will I proceed? Yes, I will. Good. Tobias, you had a bad weekend because you sit in the back today? Pardon me?
No.
No? Ah, okay, you want to avoid that. You have friends? Oh.
That's what I like to call them.
Oh. B, because it's recorded, I have to add that it was just a joke, and I use jokes to make students feel happy in the lecture and to listen to me, and it was not offending.
You totally managed to make me happy.
Okay, good. You should sign a document that I can put it to our archive, make sure somebody digs this comment out that I don't run into problems. Now I lost the track of the lecture. So, what problem do we consider now? So, what we have understood so far is the following. We have our function to be reconstructed. For instance, we have to reconstruct a heart. And we have here our projections and here our projection rays and here our projection. So the geometry of this is understood. We discussed the projection matrix and we can now characterize how the hello, you're late. You had a nice weekend? You recovered from last Monday?
Yeah.
Really? Okay. So we know how these 3D lines can be represented in the three-dimensional space with the projection matrices. And we also see that we have here a very, very specific projection model. We have here parallel. And we have parallel projection lines. And there are now two things that we have to mention. We are very, very happy that we have parallel projection lines because it makes life so much easier. Yeah, the projection model is a linear mapping. We have the Fourier slice theorem. We have the nice coordinate transform. We have the filtered back projection algorithm. Everything is wonderful. So from a mathematical point of view, we can tell now the electrical engineers, physicists, mechanical engineers, just build a system for me that captures projections where we have parallel X-ray projection lines. Yeah? And then we push it to the desk of our friends and colleagues and we wait for their solution. And then they will come back and say, I have excellent news. I build a system for you. We can capture images. I have a wonderful X-ray tube that is not dead after 1 hour of runtime. And look what happened. The only drawback that we have is that our X-ray tube has an X-ray focus. And the X-rays are no longer parallel. They are all intersecting here in the X-ray focus. Yeah. So that is the projection geometry we have to deal with. The projection lines are no longer parallel. The chalk cannot break anymore. That's the advantage. But it's very interesting. The projection lines are no longer parallel. Of course, we start to be very nervous now, yeah, because we say we have everything under control for parallel projection lines. So we look at the scenario and then we tell the physicists, look, you don't have an infinitely small point here. You have an area for your focal point, so please go back and fix that. And in the meantime, we have to fix our algorithms, right? And now the question is, how can we transfer the ideas that we have developed so far on this special situation? And if we look at the 2D, 1D case, and we have this bundle of projection lines, we call this fan beam acquisition geometry. This is called parallel acquisition geometry, and this is the fan beam and these methods are the parallel reconstruction methods, and these are the fan beam reconstruction methods. Yeah? That's why our next chapter is called fan beam reconstruction. Yeah? Fan beam reconstruction. Good. And we will now discuss two different classes of methods for fan beam reconstruction. And we will, at the end, we will just look at the whole scenario. And then we will try to find out of the projection lines those that are approximating the parallel situation as much as possible. Let me give you a good intuition what we are now doing, okay? So for those of you who attended interventional medical image processing, they know it already, but the others, I mean, if you think about how images are acquired in our eye, what happens? We have our lens system, we have a perspective projection model. I have, you know, a set of projection lines that is just going into my eye on the left and right. And if I acquire now a set of images, so I walk and I acquire a set of images like this here. Yeah? So I have here the path of the optical center. So I move my smartphone along this path, and here is the optical center. And with each optical center, I have this bundle of projection rays. Yeah? These are not X-rays, but optical projection rays, like here. Yeah? These are the projection rays. And if I want to reconstruct a view where the focal point is here, I can do the following. I can say, if I want to reconstruct this view, I need the projection rays. I haven't acquired an image at this point, but I need the projection rays, so I can say, okay, this projection line is the same like this one. Then I have here one view, so I need here a projection line. I take it out of this image. I need another one. I just read the color value out of this projection rays. So I take all the images I have acquired to build up a new image using the projection rays. And what we are now doing is, one sentence added here. For instance, if you have an endoscope and you move around in the belly, yeah, and you want to have an image where you are one meter away from the patient, then you can take all the images and build an image that you could never ever acquire with a camera without opening the belly, yeah, by just using this idea and sorting the projection rays properly. And here we do the same now. So we rotate the whole thing around the patient. And then we say, for this detector here, we want to have a parallel geometry. And then we collect the projection lines out of the set of all the projection lines, such that we get the most parallel projection lines to generate this image. It's just a reorganization of the projection lines. So we take the whole scenario and start to reorder things. Yeah, that's the idea. And now the question for us is, how do we find the line that is closest to the parallel line for the parallel projection? And now we are back to the geometry business. Yeah, and this is something you can, equipped with this idea, you can, right now, you can leave the lecture hall, go home and think about it, and you will find the solution. It's not so difficult. Yeah? So if you want to leave, feel free to feel free to do it at home. Okay, good. You got the core idea? we are just resorting things. Hello, morning. Nice to have you with us today. Good. So we are resorting things. Good. That's the idea. So here for the motivation, these are the parallel projections. This is the simplest geometry. And then we can generate sinograms. And we know how to generate the sinogram. You take the 1D projection and just put it here, column by column, into the sinogram. And then you get these sinusoidal functions. And you see, if you look from this projection to it, you should just have two brighter elements. Where do we have two brighter elements? Here, for instance, we have two. Here we have two. Here we have two. Here we have three, so these are views where we are here. So it's intuitively correct, the sinogram. Yeah. We see it's plausible. That seems to be correct. The first systems have been built with parallel acquisition geometry. So there was a special setup, and it was very hard to build that, and they also have used radioactive material to generate the X-rays, not an X-ray tube, in the first experiments, and they had parallel projection. The acquisition took 5 minutes. The reconstruction took 30 minutes. It's not so much considering the computational power they have been equipped with, but they just reconstructed a 64 by 64 or 80 by 80 slice, so it was not so huge. The system of equations that they had to solve was 80 by 80 pixels. And this picture here was stolen from Wikipedia, and you can look it up there. And I also told you about the story why a music company came up with the most exciting innovation in the 70s for medical engineering. Now we have the fan beam geometry. Yeah? The fan beam geometry, we have our optical center or our X-ray focus, and we have a bundle of projection lines that do not intersect in the point of infinity, but at the X-ray focus in our X-ray tube. And if we look at the first system, so we have here our X-ray tube with the X-ray focus. Here you have your detector. And it's also interesting to see that the detector here is not straight, but it's a curved detector. Yeah, a curved detector. So the distance of each point on the detector to the center is constant. That will be a nice this nicely affects the algorithms. But if nothing happens, if think about the fact that this is straight, and if there is just air in it here, not so much happens. But the problem is if you the attenuation value does not change so much if you have just this small distance here in the air. But the problem is that the farther you are away from the center, then the samples here, the farther they are away from the center, the sparser the samples will be. So if you have this bended structure here, then the distance of all the points to the detector, of all the points on the detector to the X-ray focus is constant, and the sampling is equidistant for all the points. That's the reason why this is mathematically better to handle. Yeah? If we have a non-uniform sampling, and my friend over there already asked about sampling theorem and all the problems with that, then you might have harder math to deal with. Sir? I don't remember your first name.
Max.
Okay. I don't speak German within 8:30 to 10 Monday morning. Scatter scatter correction.
So
I mean, there are many, many practical reasons why this is advantageous. So for us now, from a reconstruction point of view, it's also nice to have an equidistantly sampled detector. Of course, due to the donut structure geometry, you also make better use of the space, and you have also some advantages with respect to scattering and scatter correction. That's also right. You are happy with my answer? No? You should smile if you are happy, then I feel better. So again, we stole one picture. And what we are now doing is the following. Let me just wipe the board. So we have here our X-ray focus. We have here our detector. We have here our rotation center. Yeah, that's the center. That's basically where the patient at the end will sit or lie. Then we have the central projection line that intersects the detector element orthogonally. So that's the only guy within the bundle of projection rays that intersects the detector in orthogonal angle. That's the only guy where we can say that's the one we need if we want to use our framework for parallel projections, because the parallel projection rays all intersect the detector plane orthogonally. So that's the detector, and that's the X-ray focus. And that's the rotation center. And we call this distance here D. Okay? That's the distance of the focus to the rotation center. And then we have our coordinate system here. And this angle here we call beta. This is the rotation angle. That's the angle that we have in between the central projection ray and the y-axis, okay? And then we have here our other projection rays. And this angle here of the projection ray that we consider, and now it just becomes complicated due to the fact that we have so many angles, but it's not complicated. It's basic geometry, but confusing in a way that we have so many angles, okay? It's again the same trick. I explain simple things to you using a complex framework to make it look hard. And how do we call this angle here? Huh? Gamma. Where do you know it from? Oh, okay. Gamma. We could also call it alpha. It doesn't make a difference. We just have to rename all the gammas here. But the literature uses gamma. And this here is our rotation angle theta. Yeah. So if I have here the orthogonal line, then I have here my theta. My theta. Good. And what I can now do is the following. I can now say the measurement I do here, the transformed measurement, logarithm normalized, the I0 normalized, blah, blah, blah. This value here can be expressed by two values. This is the measured value for a given angle gamma and a given angle beta for the whole scenario. For the whole scenario. If I use the straight detector, ladies and gentlemen, we have to have detector elements, pixels that are changing the far away from the center. If I have a curved detector, they can have all the same size. Yeah. Good. So if I give you a gamma and if I give you a beta, you know, you look for the proper beta and then you look for the gamma and then you look what was measured on the detector element. So I can characterize all the projection points by using this 2D function, okay? Just by using the two angles. Max. Yeah, Tobias. Okay? And if we have the parallel scenario, we had P of S and theta. And what we now have to do is we have to find a way how to transform our 2D function in gamma and beta into a function of S and theta. That's the only thing we have to do. And if we can convert it, then we can use in the reconstruction algorithm for parallel reconstruction just the PS theta function that we have gained out of the conversion. Okay? That's the idea. So now we try to express, to transform this function into this one. They characterize line integrals, two more parametric line integrals. And the question is, how can we convert the two functions into each other? How can we transform things? Okay? And you can imagine what that means. At the end of the day, we look at the whole integral, and then we integral, then we do a parameter or a variable transform. We get some Jacobian, and at the end of the day, we end up with an algorithm that is very simple to what we have done so far. Yeah? That's what we have now in mind. So once again, if we go from parallel projection to the fan beam scenario, we express again our projections in terms of a 2D function. This function is no longer parameterized in terms of the rotation angle theta and the element index on the detector, but sorry, it's all recorded. But we use the angle of the central ray within rotation, and then we take the angle that expresses how much our considered ray deviates from the central ray for this particular situation, and we get the detector element, and we get the measurements. And the way we get or we compute the measurements is exactly the same. We propagate X-ray particles through the object and apply Bayer's law, the X-ray attenuation law. That's it. Okay? So what we remember, once again, we just have to do a coordinate transform to get the relationship between these two measurements. But if we just look at this scenario, we do not have a central slice or a Fourier slice theorem anymore. And the algorithms have to be adjusted. Now let's look a little bit what happens to the geometry. And this is just basic drawing. You sit down with a glass of beer or a glass of wine, and you draw it. And then you think, how much do the projections change if I vary the projection geometry? So let's look at this scenario here. This is the center. We call it A. most papers that we write, we call it lambda, but here we call it A, okay? So if we think about a setup where we acquire X-ray projections, in the future we always have in mind, we have in mind a 3D surgery room or radiology suite, and we have a 3D coordinate in space that tells us that is the point where the X-ray particles start, okay? That's where the X-ray particles are generated. We call it A. And then the bundle of projection rays starts there. So our later algorithms that we are considering will always have something like the original point where the X-ray particles are generated. Now let's think about, we have this cylinder or here this the circle, and we do a projection. And the circle has attenuation rho, has a radius r, and this is the field of view Öffnungswinkel, yeah? The field of view of the X-ray system. That's the maximum gamma interval we need to capture the whole object. Good. So the source position is a two-dimensional point in the 2D, 1D scenario. In 3D, it's a 3D point, and the rays are propagated beginning at the point AX, AY, respectively A, and then we have here the cosine sine scaled vector that goes into this direction. And we integrate over all the t. The dt is missing here. We will add it this afternoon so you can download the proper formulas. And the r, of course, you just use Pythagoras that takes here the values, maximum value for x, the maximum value for y, and within the disk, this all has to be smaller or equal to the r. Okay, so we now project it, and let's now compare how the projection looks like if we use perspective and if we use parallel projection. Is there anybody who can think about this scenario? So the comparison, what happens if I do parallel projection of a circle, and what happens if I do parallel projection? My projection will be bounded more or less by the minimum and the maximum x value here. So this is the boundary of the object. Yeah? And if I move far away, this boundary does not change. Yeah? Outside of this interval, nothing happens because there is no sphere anymore or no circle. Okay. If I have here the situation that my optical center is here, you see what happens. I lose my skin and my fingernails. This is getting wider. Yeah? And if I move the detector far away from the optical center, it's even getting larger and larger and larger. Okay? So if I generate the sinogram for fan beam geometry, it will be wider. And we have a plot here on our slides. So this is the situation where you have the parallel geometry, and on the next slide, this is the situation where you have the here the distance flips. This is the situation for parallel geometry. This is the situation for fan beam geometry. And here we have an example where we increase the distance where we increase the distance, the sinogram will be smaller. And the farther we get away from the object with our X-ray source, the more we have the situation of parallel projection lines, right? Yeah? The farther we go away, the more we have the situation of parallel projection lines. That's what I didn't see yesterday. I was thinking, what is shown here? Okay, good. And if you have partial object, then your sinogram is incomplete. And that also tells us later on when we will consider the problem, or this also this also tells us later on that we have a problem if the object is not completely in the field of view, we will have to deal with sinograms that are incomplete. Okay? So think about the situation, and we call this truncation in reconstruction, that you have one person that was a valued McDonald's customer or Burger King customer, and the field of view is not covering the whole belly. Yeah? Then you have cutoffs in your sinogram, and you have line integrals missing. And if you have line integrals missing within our reconstruction, that means that you have gaps in your Fourier transform that you use for reconstruction. And the question is, what type of artifacts are generated by these gaps in the Fourier transform? And guess what we did when we started here to do research when I came to Erlangen? I was listening and I heard there are gaps in the sinogram. Then I was thinking there are also gaps in the X-ray images due to defects in the detector elements. So why don't we use our interpolation methods in the Fourier domain and deal with truncation? And we did it within half an hour, and it was a cool paper. It was a cool paper. That's how science works, yeah? Think across the boundaries. Be a fresh thinker. Come up with crazy ideas and just try it, and quite often you find something interesting. Okay, so truncation is an issue. Good. And if you deal with MATLAB and if you are familiar with MATLAB, you know there is the function sinogram. You can generate a sinogram, so you can take the picture of your boyfriend or of your girlfriend, or whatever, of your dog. And you can generate sinograms, and you also can, you have an additional parameter in the sinogram function where you can tell the system what type of projection model you want to have. Yeah? If you have no projection model mentioned, then it's parallel projection, but you can also add perspective projection model, and then you can also compare what happens to your boyfriend if you have perspective or orthogonal projection in the sinogram. Yeah. Good. And now we need to talk about the situation. What happens if we project points, single points, and if we take the projected points and just smear them back by using the back projection step without filtering. And what happens here is if I have a point like this, so I have to reconstruct a function where I have one point, and I generate the projections. How will the sinogram look like, Ludwig? Pardon me?
I'm sorry.
How will the sinogram look like if you have one point? I'll tell you how the sinogram will look like if the point sits in the center. Let me do the hard stuff, yeah? That's the professor's task. Okay? So the sinogram will look like this. Okay? And now you know it, and now you can generalize. What happens if the point is not in the center? It will be a sine function, yeah? Something like this. And if I have it at another point, I have something like this, and so on. Okay? So I have here different point locations. And if I look at the different projections and the point is moving here, around, I can smear back the point through the volume. And if I initialize the object to be reconstructed with zeros and I add up the value that I have observed here for all points that are visited by the projection line here or by the smearing back line, here I will have a higher value because here they all intersect and they all will add up. Here I will have lower values, okay, because they do not intersect. The closer I get, the higher the point will be, so I will get, you know, something like a bump in the middle. Yeah, that was the idea of back projection that we have intuitively introduced. And the question is, pardon me? Something related to it? No? And if we do this for many projections, we get these stars. Yeah, and the point spread function tells us how a point is smeared by this system in the back projection step. So we have a point in 2D, we do the X-ray projections, we smear it back by just a back projection step, and we get this blurred point. And the point spread function basically tells us how much is a point blurred with the optical system we have used. Yeah? Or if you use a standard camera and you have a phantom where you have lines that are separated by 1/10 of a millimeter, yeah, then you can see how this geometry is mapped on your detector. And the mapping is basically characterized by the point spread function. It tells you what happens to a Dirac impulse on your detector, how much is it smeared. Yeah? Okay, so the point spread function, without doing all the theoretical characterization of it, for us it's just how is a single point smeared by the acquisition device. Okay? So we draw a line through the reconstructed point that is perpendicular to the detector. We repeat it for every detector position and we get the star, and here where all the lines intersect, we get the highest value. Yeah? And what we observe is that the point spread function is shift invariant. It's shift invariant. So the point spread function does not change. The effect of smearing does not change with the position of the point. Okay? Does not change with the position of the point. It's a shift invariant system. And if we have fan beam geometry, what we can do, okay, we rotate around the object, we get all the central rays. And what we can do is we can take all the central rays. If the point is in the center, it's the central ray. If not, we can take all the rays that intersect the point that I want to reconstruct. And these are the rays that hit the point. Yeah? So I'm with my X-ray tube at this position A, and there is the point. I look at the ray that intersects the point, and I can now smear back it. All the other rays in this scenario where the X-ray focus is at this point, they do not intersect the point, so they are zero and they do not contribute to the reconstruction, right? Only those rays that intersect the point give us a valid value that contributes to the reconstruction results. All the others just give zero, meaning there is no information along the ray. We ignore it. So I can do this intersection for all the positions of my X-ray tube, and I get again a point spread function. And we can show mathematically, and we see intuitively, that the point spread function, the way the point is smeared, is not affected by the fact whether we use parallel projection or whether we use fan beam projection. Yeah, there is always here the origin of the X-ray, and we have the intersection with the point, and this ray contributes to it. And if you rotate around the object, then the point spread function will be the same for both geometries. There is a mathematical proof for it. You can find this in the literature, we can waste or we can invest two lectures to look into it, but we do not gain so much information out of that to build algorithms for reconstruction. So please trust me at this point. Believe me. Do you trust me? That's very nice, thank you. Trust me, the point spread function does not change with the acquisition geometries that we are considering right now. Yeah? So if I sit next to you in the oral exam and I ask the smart question, can you tell me something about the point spread function, how this behaves with different acquisition geometries, then you can say, we have shown intuitively in the lecture that these two point spread functions are the same. Okay? Good. And for a complete circle, this pattern is also shift invariant and does not change. So if you move it around, then the point spread function does not change if we have the curve detector. So that's the important message here. It can be shown that the full circle point spread function is equivalent to the parallel beam point spread function. You're smiling? Is it different in China? No, it's the same. Different cultures, different results, maybe. That's the nice thing in mathematics, yeah. It's the same everywhere, if it's logical and right. It's good. What? Zeng. Ah, yeah, Zeng. But he's not Chinese. I think he is from... He's Chinese?
Yeah.
Of course. Okay, I thought he's from Korea or something. I mean, he's in the US, so. Anyways.
After all, he's American.
Huh?
After all, he's American.
He's a citizen of our planet, so it's. You know, the boundaries are more and more blurring and doesn't matter at all. Good. What does Zeng mean?
It's just
like Müller in Germany.
Yeah.
Mm. Good. And now again, one thing that just comes out of the blue without a proof, and also in Zeng's book, it comes out of the blue without a proof. It can be shown that the point spread function is 1 over R. Yeah. Where R is the distance of the currently considered point to the rotation center. So if you have the blurred reconstruction, you have to convolve. So what we do now is we take the projections, we smear them back, yeah, we smear them back, and we get this blurred point. Yeah, we see there is a point in the scene, but it's very blurred. It's low pass filtered, and the question is, how can we get the original signal? If we know about the point spread function or the inverse of the point spread function, we can compute the original signal by a 2D convolution. So we apply a 2D convolution to the smeared back projection and we get the original function. So what we have to do is nothing else but convolve the smeared reconstruction with this 1 over R kernel. Okay? Oh, we have the center, we have a point, x, y. The radius is the square root of x squared plus y squared. 1 over r characterizes the point spread function. We convolve the signal by this, and we get the original signal. Okay? And it's a 2D convolution. And how to generalize convolution from 1D to 2D, I think that's something you can find using your powerful tool called Google. Okay? And now we go one step further. Now you say, Yixin, it's too simple, right? Right? It looks so simple. It must be more complicated. So what do? I look at it in the Fourier domain. So I bring back the complex numbers and the Fourier transform, and you all feel it's more complicated here. So what do we do? we look at the Fourier transform of this. There is a mistake here. You have to see there is a mistake there. F and B should be changed. That's a typo. So we compute the Fourier transform, and the convolution ends up to be a multiplication. And here must be a plus. That's what I already corrected. This will be updated this afternoon. OK? What happened?
Is it a typo on the first line or on the second?
This one is the right one here.
OK. So the first one is like B equals F.
Yeah. Then F can be obtained by B of X by. I would more stick to this version here. We convolve it, and we have here a B and here a F. But I'll fix that. Sorry for that. We will continue with this here, So we have here. Yeah, that's the problem if you don't do the details. I guess the first one is the right one, and then we transform it into the Fourier domain. And here must be a plus. That's the Fourier transform of this one here. Yeah? That's here the frequencies. And if you have one, if you have a vector, sorry for that. I mean, I can tell you these slides have been made by Andreas and blame him for it, but I'm not doing it. Yeah? I'm not doing it. I would never do things like that. If we have a vector, let's say wx, wy, and you want to compute the absolute value of it, the length of it, yeah? It's the square root of the sum of the squares. So this here, and there is a plus. Read this as plus. Yeah? This is the Chinese version of plus. Yeah? This is the Chinese version of plus. So this is the absolute value of the w vector. So we have the product of the observation, the measurement, the smeared back projected measurement. You see the B, that's the Korean version of a B. And this is the Russian version of an F. So I have all the nations. I mean, look at this. We have a function multiplied, not with W absolute value, but 1 over W absolute value. That is more an indicator that the second row is right, but I'm not sure right now. I'll fix that on Thursday. So again, we have the absolute value function multiplied in the frequency domain with another Fourier transform, and again, this looks like a convolution, right? That is a convolution, and it's very similar to the other reconstruction method. I'm not so happy with it now. But here we have W with a B. That looks more right again, yeah? I mean, the bad thing here is that we have a one-to-one correspondence between convolution and multiplication, right? So there is one intermediate step that is currently not clear to me, and I have to fix that on Thursday. Good. Here it is. Yeah? So the blurred function is the original function convolved with 1 over r. then the Fourier transform of 1 over R is 1 over the absolute value of W. Then we have this, and then we multiply with the absolute value of W, and we see that we have the smeared measurement, the back projected measurement multiplied with the absolute value of omega in the Fourier domain, which is actually very similar to the back projection algorithm we have seen. Yeah? So where is the error? Let's go back here. Full screen. Where is the error? Here is the error. Yeah? This has to be an F, and this has to be a B. Huh? This is Chinese F, and this is Chinese B. I'm sorry for that. This is plausible, and here we see that there is something wrong. I'm sorry for that. I should have noticed this yesterday. But you know, if you have all these things in the back, so you look at it and, okay, I can explain it. And so I just want to have full screen mode. Yes. So what we have here, back projection and filtering algorithm. So we smear back and then we filter. We smear back, compute the Fourier transform, and filter. Very similar to the parallel situation. Very cool. So you can implement this on the yeah. You do the back projection, and then you smear things back, and then you use the point spread function, and here you end up again with a 2D. Absolute value function. And now we will look into the parallel fan beam conversion. And let me skip this here. I don't like this figure. I like this here more. This tells us all. Now we have to find a relationship between the theta, the gamma, and the beta. And my daughter is now in the seventh grade, the third year in the Bavarian high school. And she's exactly solving problems like this. Yeah? So you have some triangles, and then you have to find which angle is which one. And then the only thing you have to know is the following. The sum of all the angles within a triangle is 180. Yeah, it's 180. That's the only thing. Yeah, you walk this way. I don't have to explain it to you. The sum of angles in a triangle is 180. So you are a third, fourth year student at our university, and what you learn is the sum of the angles in a triangle is 180, and it's sufficient to explain the transform of parallel geometry to fan beam geometry. So let's look at the situation. This is our detector, okay? And our detector indices are given by S. So the detector element is indexed by S, okay? This here is our rotation angle theta. Our rotation angle theta. And then we know that this angle here is 100, this angle here is 90 degrees. So what is this angle? Well, this is this one plus 90 degrees plus this one. And this one here is 90 degrees minus theta. So the 90 is just dropped away. So here, this is 90. Minus theta, 90 theta. Good. What is this angle here? Who can tell me what this angle here is? What is this angle? This one here. 180 minus theta. And now we have gamma plus beta plus 180 minus theta, and that's the sum of all the angles in the triangle, and I was telling you the fundamental result that the sum has to be 180. And now, equipped with the first year high school math, you can get rid of the 180. Now they are looking what the future president is teaching here. It's very interesting, so. Okay, so we just subtract this here and we get the important result that theta is gamma plus beta. Oh, Stefan, did I do something wrong? Yes.
The 90 degree angle shouldn't be at the optical center.
Pardon me? It is also the optical center, yeah.
When O is the optical center, then the 90 degree angle should be next to beta.
We have our rotation angle. Pardon me?
Maybe it's just drawn differently or
The detector is down there, right? Right. The detector is down there. But does that change the... No, it doesn't change. We look at a very, very specific situation here. The projection ray P of S theta is gamma beta. So this is the ray that has to intersect the detector orthogonally. And you're saying this has to be just the central ray. Let's go back to the figures of Andreas. Maybe he has explained that better. So let's try to understand Andreas' figures. I was more happy with the figure that is in the book. So here, we have our beta, yeah? That's our angle here, our beta. Here we have our gamma, and here this is the ray that is associated with beta and gamma. These are the two angles, okay? So then we...
I think now I see it. So it's the O is just the point which we want to reconstruct, and the optical center is along the top line.
Along the top line. Here. Or what does it mean, top line?
Yes.
Yeah. So then we have here our orthogonal detector element. Here that's orthogonal. That's the German notation of a 90 degree angle. Yeah. The international notation is this square that we always add there. Then we have here the angle theta. That's the rotation angle. And if we look at the geometric relationships here with this simple rule, we have the relationship that gamma plus beta is theta. Yeah? So the theta is the sum of the other two angles. Okay? And now the question is, what is S? Well, here we have the 90 degree angle. So we have the sine of this. The sine of this is this divided by the side that is on the opposite side of the 90 degree angle. That's something you learn in the fifth year of high school. Which slide?
I think it was one of the first slides, probably.
Yeah, that was the theta. That was not the theta that I mentioned here. Yeah.
No. Like really one of the first slides of the class. Like when you define your gamma and your beta for the first time. It was
on the
it was on the blackboard. Okay, sorry. Okay, yeah. It's that image over there.
Right behind you. On the blackboard.
Yeah, it's on the blackboard. Because then, like, the angle between the projection ray and the detector is not 90 degrees. So
yeah, that's what we have fixed right now already, no? That was the problem.
Okay, but then you cannot use this theorem. You cannot use that the angle inside the small triangle.
Okay, so let's ignore all this and let's think in detail about this now. So that's the scenario, yeah? So we have here our rotation angle theta. Yeah, that was our rotation angle theta. Then we had our angle, and this one here is beta, okay? This one here is beta, and this one here S, and this one here is gamma. Okay? You agree on that? Good. So this angle here is 90 degrees. It's the central ray. This is the optical center. So we call this angle here, let's say alpha, and we know that alpha plus beta plus gamma is 180 degrees. Okay? Now we have to think, what is the alpha? What is the alpha? So we know gamma plus 90 degrees here. And now we need to think what is, here is theta. Theta, this here. Now we need to know what is gamma plus 90 degrees. Plus this angle here, how do we call it?
Sigma.
Is also 180 degrees. Okay. So do we see what sigma is? Based on this scenario, this here is 180. Minus alpha, okay? 180 minus alpha. This here is 90 degrees. So we know this one here. So 180 minus alpha plus 90 plus this angle here. Plus sigma prime is 180. So we forget about this, and we have alpha sigma prime minus alpha is minus 90. So sigma prime is sigma plus 90. Okay, so we have this one here. Then we need to think about what is this one. This is 90 plus beta. and we have to compute the difference from 180. Then we get this one, and then we should end up with sigma. Sigma is alpha plus beta. Should we do that? Okay, let's do that. So we have here, give me another angle. I mean, you know, very, very basic math, yeah? So I can only screw it up. Hmm?
Theta.
So we have beta plus theta is 90. Then we have theta plus 90 plus sigma prime prime is 180. So sigma prime prime is, pardon me? Theta plus 90 plus, this is just theta here, yeah?
The sigma prime prime should be?
Theta, if I'm not mistaken. Should be theta?
Theta, the rotation angle.
Sigma prime prime is this one here. Yeah. So, right. So that's theta. Theta. So we have now I have to go one step back. You screw me up here. I screw everything up now. Good. Somehow now I need to get alpha. Alpha is, where is it again? Alpha. Yes?
Can I do it?
Yes? He sees it way faster.
I think in parallel,
Sigma ist gleich Beta und dann haben wir es doch, ja. Ja. Ich weiß, aber ich muss es mir jetzt langsam überlegen und Sie wissen ja, ne, es geht dann über ein paar Berge, bis man die Lösung hat und am Schluss sieht man es dann doch ganz schnell. Das war ein didaktisches Desaster, ja. Vor allem, wenn sie das Video guckt, dann denkt sie, na, der Alte, der... Ja, okay, gut. Ja, ja.
Ja.
And that's exactly what was drawn on the figure, right?
Yeah. And
this line was drawn on the figure.
Yeah.
If you look at the figure here, why did I lost the... So this was shown in the figure, this situation. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
And her question is that because the first, it's too high for me.
No, you can move it.
Okay. The projection range in this angle, and we define this as gamma. Then we also in this situation in parallel beam. The detector is like this, so we need to draw a line.
Like this, and then you have the right angle there. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's okay, I got it.
Yeah. If this is theta, then this angle is also theta, then this angle equals gamma plus